Bruce Springsteen, Elvis Presley, Mick Jagger, Jimi Hendrix, Bono, Kurt Cobain, rock stars all, more than mere musical celebrities, icons of their times. But my guest this hour says the era of true rock stardom might be over. Culture commentator David Shumway examines the making of seven modern musical icons and their legacies. And he looks at how changes to the economy have impacted the way Americans think about and consume music. Is the rock star a thing of the past? Will there ever be another living artist who impacts society for decades to come? David Shumway on the making of musical icons after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks, thanks again for joining us for our second hour today. Bruce Springsteen is considered one of the greatest rock stars of all time. But why is his music, why is he so celebrated? What is at the root of that? What separates Bruce Springsteen from the other rock and rollers of his time? I ask because rock stars and their cultural significance is the focus of this hour of Midday. A rock star, you know one when you see one, or you can certainly name one when asked to, but what makes a rock star a rock star? What's the difference between being merely talented and truly a star? In a new book on this subject, Carnegie Mellon professor David Shumway makes the distinction between stardom and celebrity. He writes, quote, "All stars are celebrities, but not all celebrities are stars." David Shumway makes his case by chronicling the careers and significance of five performers in two bands, Elvis Presley, Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, James Brown, the Rolling Stones, the Grateful Dead, and Bruce Springsteen. Meanwhile, his exclusion of artists whose careers started in the 1980s through today fits his theory that contemporary musicians lack the cultural significance that makes rock stars, and that shifts in the economy and the music industry have changed the way Americans think about and use music. And because of that shift, the idea of rock stardom, of a rock star, could become a thing of the past. Some think it already is. David Shumway is a professor of English and literary and cultural studies at Carnegie Mellon. He's also the author of American Civilization, A Genealogy of American Literature as an Academic Discipline. That was his earlier book. And this book is called Rockstar, The Making of Musical Icons from Elvis to Springsteen, and it's published by Johns Hopkins University Press right here in Baltimore. So, David Shumway, welcome to Midday on WYPR. It's nice to have you with us.
Hello. Great to be here.
You know, you say rock star to someone, and that term still has significance today. It still means something, but it gets applied to all kinds of people, including Pope Francis. I just heard it used last week in that context. You know, he's a real rock star. But when it comes to applying it to actual musicians, there are fewer and fewer people on that list.
Yes, that's true. As the great stars of who emerged in the 60s and 70s pass on, I think there will be fewer of them. And I don't think it's because people are less talented now or the music is any less interesting, but simply because the mediascape has become fragmented and music itself is less culturally central than it was back then.
The idea of rock stardom or rejecting rock stardom, it seems to be almost cooler than rock stardom itself now. Would you agree with that?
Well, there has, of course, been a long history of rejection of stardom in the music industry because there's a feeling that once you become too popular, too much of a celebrity, you lose your authenticity. This is actually one of the things that deeply troubled Kurt Cobain. He couldn't really believe in his own stardom. He believed that somehow it was false. And it's probably one of the things that contributed to his suicide, his concern about that problem. It was also true of Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead. I mean, it didn't trouble him as much, but he also worked hard to reject the trappings of stardom. So in a way, even though I think he and the band were stars, they tried to avoid appearing as such.
We're going to start with Springsteen because of what you were just saying about him. There were some points in his career, Bruce Springsteen, where his fans or critics would say, I guess both would say, or wonder about his authenticity, whether he was headed to popular rock stardom, and if that was going to be a bad thing. That was going to ruin the original Bruce.
Well, in fact, it goes all the way back to the moment when he first really did become a star in 1975, when he appeared on the covers of both Time and Newsweek.
Right.
Of course, appearing on those covers made him a star almost immediately, but one of those articles, the one in Newsweek, questioned whether he was anything more than just the product of record company hype, while the other one, in Time, written by Jay Cox, who was a great fan of Springsteen, celebrated him as, implicitly a return of rock and roll to its authentic roots. So there were these two contrasting views. And the Time magazine view clearly won out for a while, but then Springsteen's record that came out at that time, Born to Run, was of course a big hit. In fact, it was the first record to go platinum. It was a new music industry designation. But it wasn't until Born in the USA, with its multi-million-dollar sales, that people began once again to question whether Springsteen wasn't oversold to the public. And again, many people at that point, I think, did worry about that. But on the whole, Springsteen has, I think, generally persuaded people of his own authenticity.
Oh, I definitely believe so. But there were moments when someone might have questioned that. I'm going to read something from your book here. It speaks to this question of popularity. The growth of the record industry and the importance of rock and roll to it contributed to a growing skepticism about artists who attained great popularity and financial success. Many rock fans and critics were now unable to accept such popularity as a genuine achievement, something that Elvis, the Beatles, or the Rolling Stones never had to face. But Springsteen did face that during this period, but he somehow got through it. And look at him today. I think he's 65 years old, and he's still going strong.
I think one of the reasons he was able to get through it is that he did not just continue to try to reproduce the sound of Born in the USA, but he continued to experiment, to branch out. So if you think about the albums he recorded since then, I mean, they've ranged from rock albums like The Rising to more folk-sounding albums like The Ghost of Tom Joad, mm-hmm. which is and even more folk music oriented in the Seeger Sessions. So he's continued to experiment, to branch out, and I think people recognize that effort as one that comes out of genuine artistic commitments.
Yeah, people recognize it, but you're so overwhelmed by the power of the record industry, the power of the media and the press to put someone in front of us and say, this is a talented person. Here, this is the next big thing, the next big star. So you're immediately suspicious of it.
That's certainly true. And that problem has gotten worse because, celebrity seems to become more and more ephemeral every day. I mean, when we have people like the Kardashians are constantly in the news, but no one can tell you why they're there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they're genuine celebrities, aren't they?
That's right.
Particularly because you don't know why.
That's right. They're famous for being famous.
Right.
As the phrase goes.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about physical appearance, because this comes up in your book with each person that you write about here. Springsteen. Then we're going to talk about Elvis, and we're going to move to Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones. Just so you know the order I'm taking things in today,
okay,
David. So physical appearance. I was looking at some photographs of Bruce today. I remember him from the 70s, that skinny bearded guy from Jersey. And then in the 80s, he sort of bulked up and became muscular, really cut, showed off his guns, right?
Yes.
Right. You have some interesting observations about the physical appearances and the changes in a star over time.
Well, in Springsteen's case, I think it was a intentional attempt to remake himself. His early appearance connoted a certain bohemianism. He seemed like he was trying to look like a 60s musician. But then beginning later in the 70s, it actually starts with Darkness on the Edge of Town, he begins to shift to embody more the look of the young adults of his cohort of working class people, many of whom, of course, were at that point, their early 20s, hadn't been to college, were looking for jobs, having to experience some of the disappointments that come with giving up the dreams of youth. Bruce wrote a number of songs about that very subject. So by the time he gets to Born in the USA, he seems to want to embody even more powerfully this image of the laboring man, the working class guy. Several of his music videos show him in jobs like running a pile driver or as an auto mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that would not have been as convincing had he not actually changed the shape of his body and his hairstyle and those kinds of things.
One thing he never seemed to suffer from was political backlash for his views, which, these anti-war messages, suspicion of government, is suspicion of the corporate class and income disparity, all those things that he talks about from the stage. He didn't seem to suffer from that.
That's right. It seems to me that he's an unusual figure in that he's managed to express what are now recognized as distinctly left-wing opinions without generally alienating many people who don't share those opinions. And I think that demonstrates his rather unusual status as a cultural icon, a representative of something that people recognize as transcending political views. It's rather remarkable given how, so many other aspects of our culture are so divided these days.
David Shumway is our guest. We're speaking to him about his latest book called Rockstar, The Making of Musical Icons from Elvis to Springsteen, published by our own Johns Hopkins University Press here in Baltimore with a foreword by Anthony DeCurtis. So let's go back to Elvis then. That's actually where you start, but I'm going to sort of jump all over the place here today. But let's talk about Elvis as a star and how he came to be a star. What exactly happened there? Did television make Elvis?
Television absolutely made Elvis. In 1956, which is the year that Elvis, or just after Elvis, got his RCA record contract. He started with Sun Records, a small label in Memphis, recorded some great songs, but he probably would have never been widely heard had he not gotten this national record deal. He appeared on national television 12 times. If you think about that, other than people who are on a standing gig like Dancing with the Stars or something like that, musical performers today don't get to appear anywhere near that often. What's more, in 1956, there were three networks. So if you wanted to watch television, most people, exceptions were a couple big cities, you watched one of those three networks. So Elvis basically got enormous exposure because of the reach of television at that time. The key moment, though, came in the summer of 1956 when he appeared on the Milton Berle show. And Milton Berle had been one of the highest rated shows on TV. It was actually a bit in decline. But this was a coup to get on Milton Berle. And he performed Hound Dog. And his dancing on that number shocked the nation. It's partly because of the size of the audience, which was extremely large, very, very high ratings. But it was partly because of the way he was photographed. In some of the earlier performances, his his shaking of the hips and other kinds of pelvic gestures were not really emphasized. He was shot from above or from greater distance. But the camera work for the Milton Berle show really communicated this. Moreover, there's this key moment in several times in the broadcast where you see a young girl responding ecstatically to Elvis's dancing. Well, this clearly shocked enormous numbers of people. And there were all kinds of complaints. Critics called him lewd. They said he was performing like a burlesque dancer. He was doing the bump and grind. And it's really from that point on that Elvis becomes a really controversial figure. White citizens' councils in the South organize events to burn his records. He's called a communist based on nothing more than the fact that his dancing is dangerous and the fact that he sounds African-American. Television made Elvis Presley, there's no question
about it. It almost instantly sexualized him, didn't it?
That's right. I mean, if you'd only heard his records, you would have not gotten the half of it. And of course, at that time, Elvis's live performances had been largely restricted to the South. He had not really performed that many times outside the South. And so most people before television had no idea what he looked like on stage. And as long as he performed his dancing in small clubs for relatively, in-the-know audiences, they probably wouldn't have troubled people that much. But once it came into people's living rooms, that was different.
We're going to talk some more about Elvis, Bruce Springsteen, the Rolling Stones, and others from David Shumway's book. After this short break, David Shumway, author of Rockstar, The Making of Musical Icons, from Elvis to Springsteen. You can join our conversation here on Midday at 410-662-8780. Welcome back to Midday. Talking about rock stars in this hour of the show, one of them, Bruce Springsteen, with David Shumway, who's a professor at Carnegie Mellon. His book is Rockstar, The Making of Musical Icons, from Elvis to Springsteen. And before we go back to Elvis, and then we'll get to Mick Jagger, the Grateful Dead, James Brown, a comment on Twitter here from one of our listeners about... I said Springsteen certainly didn't seem to suffer from any of his political views on stage. Well, in terms of his overall popularity, I think that is true. Would you not say? I'm not saying he didn't hear from people who criticized what he had to say. I don't remember people walking out on his concerts, any of the five that I went to. But anyway, David, what do you say about that? You mostly agree that it didn't seem to hurt his popularity.
In general, it did not. I mean, the fact that Governor Chris Christie remains an enormous fan, emblematic, I think, of many, many people who are like-minded, who like Springsteen. The only time, actually, I've heard of Springsteen having any significant negative reaction to his political views is when he performed the song 41 Shots New York.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some boos, and it was speculated that there were a significant number of New York City police officers in the audience who were unhappy with his song about the shooting of an unarmed African immigrant. But that's the sole instance that I've ever heard of an explicit unhappiness. Obviously, there are doubtless individual instances of people perhaps turning off, but I don't think that there's been a significant diminution otherwise.
Let's take a phone call here. We welcome calls. If you'd like to join our conversation with David Shumway here on Midday, 410-662-8780. David, before we go back to Elvis and then to the other figures in your book, here's a call from Sam and Glen Burnie. Sam, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to make a comment. I don't know if you mentioned this in beginning of the show, but it seems like one of the reasons we're not going to see these rock stars on that level any longer. It's just the progression of television and media. I mean, we used to have a huge captive audience, you know, when you're going way back, where it's just maybe the Ed Sullivan Show or Grand Ole Opry, and then take it all the way up to, you know, the early 90s were the last act of that, where MTV was actually showing music videos. People didn't have this expanded cable choice or internet and YouTube or satellite radio. And now, with all of that, you don't have that captive audience. Right. People are just seeking out their niche. So I just wanted to make that comment.
No, I see what Sam's saying. What do you think of that, David?
That's absolutely right. And you can add to it the fact that people increasingly listen to their music privately. In the 50s, 60s, and 70s, people often listened together, or the radio was playing while they were socializing, or they got together and listened to records as a primary activity. I think that kind of behavior is much less common today as people listen to music on their earbuds. Kind of as confirmation of this, I mean, when I ask my students, college-age students, what they listen to, they almost never listen to the same music. In fact, the music they know best is the music of my college cohort. They still listen to the music of the 60s and 70s. And they all know that music, but they don't all know the same contemporary music.
So, David, so that's really true. That's something I suspected and I wondered about, and I thought it was just wishful thinking that my kids listen to music that I did.
No, it's absolutely true. My son listens to the Beatles and Michael Jackson. He's up to Eminem now, but but you know, not so much recent stuff.
Yeah,
a few things, but.
Well, speaking of recent stuff, there's a couple of things, and we'll go back to Elvis in a minute. But I'm dying to ask you about this thing that you write about. You describe accessibility toward the end of your book, page 211, in fact, if you want to look it up quickly. You make a reference here to a band called Umphrey's McGee. And Umphrey's McGee, they like to, like, have beers, some brewskis with their fans after a concert, right? They like to hang out with their fans. They like feedback from their fans. They like to be accessible. They like to even, what, build songs or themes for concerts based on what people text them or something
right,
like that. That sounds kind of cool. It sounds like an interesting idea. But you say this accessibility reduces the possibility of true stardom.
Well, so a star is almost by definition something that shines far away. The person who lives next door to you isn't to you a star. I suppose it's a version of the old saw that familiarity breeds contempt.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying it would be impossible for Umphrey's McGee to rise to true stardom. They're actually, I think, a quite interesting band, but I do think that this form of interaction, which is rooted in what I call the new patronage, so that increasingly music is being supported not on not by the sale of commodities, but sale of records or even live performances, but by various ways in which people are encouraged to become patrons, and that is to give money to the band for something other than those two traditional things. And access is one of the things that comes as a result of this new patronage. And I believe it is likely to reduce the cultural presence of acts who rely on that form of support.
So maybe they don't want that, right? This is part of the rebellion against stardom, against that concept?
I actually don't think that's it. I think it's a way to try to figure out how to make money given the low record sales and the fact that so much music is not being paid for these days.
Right. We should mention that. I was going to mention Spotify. What do you think of that phenomenon of Spotify not paying that much for music? That kind of reduces the possibilities of what you're writing about in this book, right?
Yes, I think it's unfortunate that producers, people who make content, in all forms, are getting the short end of the stick as the internet economy develops. And this is particularly true of musicians. Well, I'm not sure it's more true of musicians than, say, authors. But both have tended to lose out to the distributors, to the people who run the internet companies, who make lots of money but don't share those spoils with the people who give them the stuff that people actually want.
Back to Elvis, David, could you talk about this concept of the feminization of male rock stars, which you bring up in your case study of Elvis Presley?
Right. So when Elvis did that dancing routine on the Milton Berle show, he was likened to a striptease artist. And the important thing about that is that it calls attention to the fact that men in the 50s, when Elvis was doing this, did not normally display their bodies as sexual objects. If you think about the images of men on television from the 50s or in the movies, usually they're wearing suits or they're wearing cowboy outfits.
The village people outfits, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Indian
right.
Sailors, soldiers, guy, maybe a guy on a motorcycle with a leather jacket.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
There are some precursors, probably most notably Rudolph Valentino, who was perceived as both a lover on screen, but also as slightly effeminate. He was a dancer before he became a movie star. But in general, the great stars, the great movie stars of the 30s and 40s and 50s were very traditionally masculine, at least in their appearances and in their behavior. And Elvis's dancing shocked people. It crossed a gender barrier. There were a few other things about Elvis that were a little bit unusual in that regard. He wore eyeshadow. He sometimes dressed in really outre clothing, like the gold lamé jumpsuit, mm-hmm. Actually was the first thing he wore, and then later the jumpsuit. All of those were not exactly on target with normal masculine dress. And so what I suggest is that Elvis kind of opened the door to other musicians beginning to play with gender codes. And so the next obvious example are the Beatles with their bangs.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Rolling Stones, just a few years later, actually appear in a billboard in drag. And then increasingly in stage dress, which is very ambiguous in its gender. Jagger wears feathers and other stuff that looks more like feminine clothing. And in fact, there's a music video for Jumpin' Jack Flash in which Brian Jones looks a great deal like Leslie Gore. He's made up in not complete drag, but clearly a very feminine facial and hair presentation. So
actually, in the Rolling Stones, you have a kind of a split between performers showing the feminine side and those showing the super masculine side. You have Keith Richards, Bill Wyman on one side, and you just mentioned Brian Jones, and then later Ron Wood, right, with Mick Jagger showing some feathers now and then. Right? Hey, yeah. Listen, before we go deeper into the Rolling Stones, Steve in Towson has a question that I'm sure David Shumway has been asked before, but for the record, we need to have this question asked on the Midday Show. Steve in Towson, go right ahead. Welcome to Midday.
Well, thanks, Dan, and it's a great show. And David just had a quick question. Where are the Beatles? I'm sure you probably have a reason as to why you've not chosen them to build this case. And I'll take my question off the air. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yes, well, that is a good question. And if I were doing a catalog of the greatest rock stars, the Beatles would have to be, at the top of the list. But my book is really a series of case studies. I'm trying to explore the various cultural meanings that rock stars had and have. And I thought that the Beatles, particular chapter on the Beatles, would probably not likely be able to get at something that most other people didn't already know. The Beatles, in some ways, are so well known, have had so much written about them. So it wasn't meant to diss them at all. And in fact, I do discuss the Beatles quite a bit in the chapter on the Rolling Stones, because the Rolling Stones defined their persona very much as the anti-Beatles.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, because I remember during the British invasion, I actually was around then, you know, there were a lot of sort of British Beatles imitators. I wouldn't call them imitators so much as similar to the Beatles in the sound that they produced, the kind of music they produced, the persona that they presented. And then came the Rolling Stones, quite different, quite very good, obviously very good musicians, but very different in contrast to the Beatles and those others who followed them.
Yes, that's right. The Stones' manager, Andrew Oldham, first did try to make the Stones look like the Beatles, but the Stones basically refused. They wouldn't wear the uniforms that Oldham wanted them to wear, and so Oldham very quickly caught on that what he should do with these guys is to make them the opposite of the Beatles and to allow them to act out their rebelliousness publicly, and Oldham exploited it for all it was worth. So he didn't invent their rebelliousness. They had that all along, but he made sure that it got out to the public.
What do you think of this? I've heard it said, I think I remember it being said at the time, that a lot of young men, boys and young men in America, were really put off by the Beatles and how girls and young women screamed about them. And then when the Stones came along, that was the band for the guys, because they didn't see them as such a threat.
Well, it might be true that it certainly wasn't true of my cohort of young teenagers, who we were in awe of young men who could get girls to react in that way. I do think, of course, that historically there was this debate among people who grew up with the Beatles and the Stones about who was better. But I don't know anybody who loved rock and roll who didn't like both bands. I'm sure there were people, but I think they were few and far between.
I think you're probably correct about that. I just thought I'd bring up the male jealousy at the outset of the Beatles being here, but the music certainly was so good and has held up for so long. And what about, speaking of holding up for so long, the Stones, you know, I mean, they're still around. So what do you make of them through time, David? We have to take a break here in a minute, but, you know, we get to the 80s, the 90s, and then the 21st century, and they're still doing concerts.
Well, they're clearly still extraordinarily good live performers.
Yeah.
The Martin Scorsese documentary about their most recent concert tour demonstrates that they haven't lost anything in that regard. Unfortunately, they haven't really recorded significant new music, I think, in most people's opinion, since the 1980s. And so there's something a little bit out of whack between their continued success on tour and their inability to continue to develop their music on record.
We're going to take another break here. We'll come back and talk some more with David Shumway as we listen to a little bit of the... Who we listen to here? Oh, Stones. Oh, Gimme Shelter. All right, good. We'll take a break, David, and come back and talk some more. And we'll take some calls for David Shumway, author of Rockstar, The Making of Musical Icons from Elvis to Springsteen. Are you jealous of the Beatles? 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance from midday, 866-661-9309. Mick Jagger, the Rolling Stones, Bruce Springsteen, Elvis Presley, others mentioned in this book by David Shumway, our guest in this hour of midday. These rock stars had more than talent. They also had unique personas that turned them into icons. David Shumway looks at the making of some of our most popular rock stars and at the changing music industry that we've talked a little bit about here already in this hour of the show. David, before we move on, I want to take a couple of calls for you. Gary in Canton with a comment about Mick Jagger and the Stones. Hi, Gary.
Hi there. My question for you is, John F. Kennedy and Mick Jagger, what do they have in common? The London School of Economics, which is internationally prestigious as a business school, Jagger is a graduate. Kennedy often boasts about attending it. There's no record of him having attended the school. Jagger is a behind his facade is an extremely shrewd businessman, and a great deal of what they did was to make money. They're still making money. And although the Beatles have sold more records, the Stones have made more money. Very foolishly, the Beatles sold their, the rights to residuals from songs and whatnot to Michael Jackson.
Well, sorry, Gary, did you have a question?
No, I was just commenting on Jagger being an MBA from London School of Economics.
Yeah.
That's often not recognized.
Well, thank you, all right, Gary. But I wonder, does that build into Mick Jagger's persona over the last 40 years? I mean, it's an interesting fact, but I don't know if that served his rock stardom, did it?
In a certain way, it did. Now, it's not true that Jagger's business skill immediately paid off for the Stones, because they actually had two very awful contracts. First with Decca Records, they didn't have had a very bad contract with their first record company, and then they had a bad management deal with a guy named Alan Klein, and so they actually didn't make as much money in the 60s as you would have thought they would have made. But by the 1970s, when they started their own record company and got out of the contract with Klein through legal maneuvering, they did in fact begin to become extraordinarily successful. And I think that the desire for money, for in fact more of everything, is part of their persona. In the book, I quote this news conference that the Stones had in 1969 in New York, just before their Madison Square Garden concerts. This was the same tour that ended in the Altamont tragedy. And Jagger is asked if he's now satisfied playing on their hit, I Can't Get No Satisfaction. And Jagger says, financially dissatisfied, sexually satisfied, philosophically trying. But financially dissatisfied, I mean, this was probably true, because they were still under the contract with Klein, mm-hmm. but they were still, of course, also very wealthy men compared to most of their audience, say. So it's a telling moment.
David, another question. This one's from Wally in Harford County. Wally, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you, Dan. David, I was wondering if you thought that Elvis started the idea that to get recognized, you do something outrageous, and then that will get you recognition, or is that way before Elvis came in?
Well, that makes you the rebel, doesn't it, if you do something outrageous, I guess. David?
You know, I don't think that Elvis actually really understood very well that he was doing anything outrageous. Elvis, I think, was fairly naive. There's a quality of innocence about his responses to interviews during this period that suggests that he doesn't really have a manipulative bone in his body, that he really is just trying to do what he does. While I think his case certainly illustrates the point that if you do something outrageous, you are likely to get noticed, I don't think Elvis danced the way he did in order to be noticed as much as to simply, it's simply what he does. It was his act.
David, I wanted to ask you something about a couple of people who are not in your book. Of course, those in your book that you profile, Elvis, James Brown. We haven't talked about him yet. Bob Dylan, the Rolling Stones, the Grateful Dead, Joni Mitchell, Bruce Springsteen. Looking at today's scene, where does someone like Lady Gaga fit in? Was Lady Gaga a rock star?
Well, Lady Gaga is doubtless a star, and she's someone who performs music which is certainly related to rock and roll. Maybe it is rock and roll. And,
she's a pop star, I guess.
But I would call her a pop star.
Yeah.
And I think it has to do not with the musical genre, but the kind of presence she has in the culture. She's an entertainer. And my history here, what I believe is that the key moment is Michael Jackson's Thriller in the early 80s starts the pendulum swinging back towards popular. So we have the 60s and 70s, popular music is defined as something which is socially and culturally challenging. It's avant-garde, it's out there, it's more than entertainment. And then Michael Jackson comes along and he's transformed himself. He used to be with the Jackson 5 essentially performing as a rock or soul star. But when he releases Thriller, he harkens back to performers like Fred Astaire, a great dancer, but who is known not because he had any political significance, but because he was a wonderful entertainer. And that's really where things have gone now. The people at the top of the charts are mostly entertainers.
I'm going to ask you about a couple of these others in the book, just to give us a little taste of why they're in there. The Grateful Dead is in your book. I always found interesting about the Grateful Dead was, even though everyone knows Jerry Garcia, even if you weren't a follower of the Dead, if you weren't a Deadhead, they let all the band members sort of front at different times, right? It's very different than the Rolling Stones, where Jagger was in front all the time.
That's right. There was no front man for the Grateful Dead. Even Jerry Garcia disavowed the role of leader, though he played it certainly from time to time. The Dead really were... they were a commune. They were a group of people who tried to make decisions collectively, who lived collectively for a certain period in their career, and whose persona, in my view, represents a kind of utopian, the possibility of a utopian transformation, even though they don't have a program for that, but but they believed in the possibility of it.
Yeah. Let's listen a little bit of another figure from your book, Joni Mitchell. What makes her so interesting, the fame that she reached in the 60s and 70s?
Well, so I think there are two things. The first is that she really defined a new genre of rock and roll, the singer-songwriter genre. She and James Taylor were the two most popular early members of that form, which is defined by a confessional stance, the idea that the singer is laying bare his or her soul to the listener in songs that are apparently purely autobiographical. The second key point about Joni Mitchell is that she's really the first rock star to present herself as representing women. That is to say, there had been female rock stars like Janis Joplin, but they really presented themselves for men. They were, and their fans were much more male than female. Joni Mitchell had a lot of male fans, doubtless, but her core audience was female, and they understood her to be expressing their point of view. And that was really an unusual thing at the time. In fact, one could argue it remains so.
I'm very interested in also in talking just here a little bit from you about Bob Dylan, following off of Joni Mitchell, because of the influence of poets here. Speaking of poets, Bob Dylan.
So Dylan, of course, began as a folk singer, and he was known primarily because his songs became anthems of the civil rights movement, largely in the voices of other people. He was a songwriter, and people, bands like, groups like Peter, Paul, and Mary made songs like Blowin' in the Wind hits. But he became a rock star in the mid-60s when he began to perform with a band and used an electric guitar. And what he did is he transferred the authority that he had gained as this spokesperson for social justice and a voice of sort of the new generation to rock and roll, and he had enormous influence. The Beatles asserted that it was Dylan who led them to begin to produce more experimental music, like the songs that they wrote for the record Norwegian Wood, the album. Dylan sang about things in his rock songs that popular musicians had never really attempted to sing about before. He was a serious guy. He transformed popular music from the image of popular music as a devoted solely to silly love songs to something that people began to take seriously as an art form.
The way the world works today, the music world works today, David, we're unlikely to see a rock star in this classic sense again?
Well, that's my belief. Of course, things could change, but given the current structure of the media and the music industry, I think that we're unlikely to have people who rise to the heights that the stars I've written about rose to. And I think we're unlikely to have stars who are understood to be serious cultural spokespeople in the way that they previously had been, or at least that won't happen as often.
This is from the foreword to your book by Anthony DeCurtis. Kurt Cobain, who you mentioned earlier in the show, Kurt Cobain marked something like the end point of rock stardom, the point when even actual rock stars rejected the role, which may be fortunate since it seems to be disappearing anyway, as David Shumway argues in this smart, provocative, and emotionally charged book. I'd hate for that to be true, but in the worlds of media and culture, we're in the grips of changes as profound as any since the invention of the printing press. In that enormous context, the loss of rock stardom may seem trivial, but as the old pre-rock era Gershwin song says, not for me. So he's in a bit in mourning over this, Anthony DeCurtis.
Well, and I share that sentiment. I believe that these stars' personas were themselves works of art, and they're things that we ought to cherish. They took an enormous creativity, and they had enormous meaning for people. And it's unfortunate if we don't see their like again.
David Shumway, I've enjoyed this conversation and your book. Thank you very much for both.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
David Shumway is a professor of English at Carnegie Mellon. His book is Rockstar, The Making of Musical Icons from Elvis to Springsteen. The publisher is Johns Hopkins University Press. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in this afternoon to Midday. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back again soon.
Midday senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The associate producer, Michael Hemowitz. Our engineers are Matt Taka and Luke Spicknell. Our interns are Connor Graham and Marjorie Goodman. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WIPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WIPR, your NPR news station.